Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Radio Free Nintendo, courtesy of NintendoWorldReport.com. I am your defunct host, Carl Castaneda, and on this episode, we've got all the way over in Europe land, Mr. Greg Leahy.
You've still got it, Carl. What a wonder.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, sir. And also James Jones in Realms Unknown.
Right. Realms Unknown.
And last up, your regular host, Mr. Johnny Metz.
Oh, hello.
So, is that it? That's all you got?
I'm so used to speaking for the first 2 minutes, I just figured I would rambling keep it low key.
So, did I do it okay, guys? Do I still have it? Do I still have the spark? The
thunder?
You sound good, man. You have a voice for radio and a face, too, I might add.
Yeah, that's what my mom always said. She's always like, Carl, you're going to grow up to be a great radio star.
Oh, this is going to be terrible. Stop listening now.
I'm just kidding. I love Carl. Feelings but not hits. In that way. So, yeah, we have a big show for you today. And unfortunately, as you might have surmised by at this point, John Lindemann's not with us. He's working his ass off at real work tonight. We wish him the best, and we hope that next week he'll be back. But yeah, we brought on Carl mainly to talk about Mad World.
Yeah.
But he knows a little something about Eternal Darkness as well.
A little bit.
And we're gonna catch back up a little bit with your listener mail. Unfortunately, with the probably going to be a huge Eternal Darkness bit, we can't do a double helping of listener mail like I kind of wanted to since we missed last week. But we're at least gonna get back in the normal pace of it, and we'll gradually catch up and get through our backlog. So anyway, not much to do in the way of intro that we haven't already done. We'll just jump into...
Well, there is one thing I think all of us need to hear. And it's going a little off the rails a little bit, so we'll keep it short. But Greg...
Yeah.
You have to know where this is going.
Oh, yeah. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
North America's team.
I thought almost that I'd been playing a bit too much Eternal Darkness recently when I experienced an in-life insanity effect that the Bills had signed Terrell Owens. But this, in fact, apparently is either ongoing insanity or it's real.
See, I'm sad that John wasn't here because we were actually trying to come up with good Bills /TO jokes.
Yeah.
Well, he can't be the worst thing that's happened to the team in the past.
No,
few years,
the fact that we still have the coach from last year is more what concerns me. But I think we should crack on.
Yeah, let's please nip this football talk in the bud right now, because I heard that Carl Castaneda owns Mad World.
It's true. The rumors are true, internet. And
you already beaten it?
No, although I've heard it's not very long. Basically, I picked up Mad World it's really a notable game in a lot of ways. I mean, it's the first game by Platinum, so right there, that's pretty notable, like the old Clover.
What, you mean at all?
At all, yeah, this is the first game they've released.
Under the Platinum.
There's Bayonetta and then that other one.
Infinite Space for the DS is still forthcoming.
Yeah, so
I thought that was out in Japan.
No, I don't think so.
And then it's also the first game we've gotten from Mitsushi Inaba since Okami. So really, in a lot of ways, it's really, really cool to have a new game from those guys. But yeah, I picked up Mad World because it seemed a lot like No More Heroes, and we all know how much I was into that game.
You say that, Carl, but when you did your top 5 games of last year on your podcast...
Oh my god, you listened to Talk 112? TAWK 112? What?
You just got called the fuck out.
He did actually acknowledge the fact that he forgot it at mid-list, but he did forget it.
Oh, shit.
Nice.
Touche, sir, touche.
Yeah.
Well, I did pick up Mad World, though, yesterday. And basically, if you don't know, it stars a dude named Jack, who there's this town that's overrun by murderous people, murdering, as they are wont to do. And basically, the Marines send in this guy, Jack, to go undercover as one of these contestants for this, Death Watch kind of game. And he rips people apart with a chainsaw and his bare fist. So that's the plot of the game. And basically, it's a lot like No More Heroes, where there's no pointing involved, which I'm a big fan of. Mm-hmm. It's basically all done by gestures and by basically jerking the analog thing, and then also the Wii Remote in any given direction. And it's actually, it's really, at first, it's a little wonky, to be honest with you, just because of the way that they...
Are you amazed at Carl's sort of removal from Nintendo terminology at this point, that the nunchuck has become the analog thing?
Yeah, I'll be honest.
Didn't take long, did it?
Yeah. You know, because seriously, it's been so long since I've actually played anything of interest on my Wii, it's been a while. That's one thing that you guys are all going to figure out when all of you finally grow the fuck up and leave the site like I did.
All right. Oh, good.
All right.
This is a great start for things.
All right. You're going to find out.
I haven't bought a Wii game since I retired from reviews.
Really?
So.
Well, yeah, but you're still getting reviewables. Like, you're still playing things.
No.
No?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
no,
shit.
I'm Chrono Trigger is my last review.
Damn.
And in fact, the last two or three reviews I did were for DS anyway.
Yeah.
So,
shit.
It's been quite a while since I got a new Wii game.
John will see us through. We'll have...
Yeah. All right, well, anyway, so basically, yeah, like I said, basically through these different gestures, we're able to pull off these combo moves to dismember people in a bunch of given ways. It's really, like, kind of limited as far as the mechanics of it. I mean, you'll find something in the environment, pick it up, slam it down on somebody, then throw them into a bunch of spikes, you know, pull their testicles off through their face, that kind of thing.
Beautiful.
It's poetic in motion, really. And, it's a lot of fun, though. It really is one of those games that's just kind of like, it's a mature game on Wii, so you kind of have to try it. And it's actually pretty fun. So,
is it mature or is it bloody?
No. It's bloody. It's not. It's very immature. It's just very bloody.
It's rated mature.
Because we're going to talk about a real mature game later.
Oh yeah. But one more thing that's notable about the game. The plot was written by the original director for Final Fantasy XII. I forgot.
We've covered this on the show previously.
Yes. Yeah. We've
once again. I've got you beat all ends up on listening to the other guy's show.
Damn.
Yeah. Apparently, Greg listens to Carl's podcast, but Carl doesn't listen to our
and Dennis,
podcast,
Dennis
which Dyack, used to be his.
Dennis Dyack would be shocked at the lack of reciprocity displayed there.
Ooh.
All right, well,
oh my.
One other game that I wanted to talk about, maybe I won't fuddle this one up as much.
Wait. Before we get off Mad World, I know you haven't had it long enough to really comment on this, Carl, but, you know, there was some talk, some chatter this week about the fact that IGN gave it a very high review. I think they gave it a 9, and they loved it. And in the review, they basically get on their knees and beg people to buy the game because it's, like, good for the platform.
Ugh,
and
that's so stupid.
And I'm sure it's a lot of fun. I can't wait to play it, but I'm renting that shit.
Yeah,
it's 5 hours long.
It's like
I am not paying $50 for it. That doesn't mean I think it's a bad game, but I don't think it's going to be worth my money.
Yeah,
all
right. Well, I mean, like, all right. From the map that I've seen, where, like, because basically when you go into the menu, it shows you a mini map, and then you choose an area to go to. From the map, it looks like there are, like, three or four different cities, and the first city, which is the only one I've finished so far, has, like, three areas in it. So seeing as how that only took me about an hour to beat, it really doesn't seem like it's going to be that long.
One question I had with respect to No More Heroes, which I've actually finished up relatively recently, is like, do you think is it going to be sort of, does it demonstrate like that it's similar to No More Heroes, but just less padded, obviously, not just in the open world stuff, but there was a fair amount of repetition in No More Heroes, even not, you know, taking
well, okay,
out the
here,
open
here,
world stuff.
Here's the thing about that, though. It does share that same trait that No More Heroes had, where there is a lot of repetition, because basically the way you complete each level is you drop into a town, you fuck some dudes up, rack up a bunch of points, and then when you reach enough points, you can open up little mini challenges, then you do those challenges, and then you get more points, and then when you have enough points, finally, you face the boss.
Yeah.
So it's that formula over and over again.
So you're saying it's the DK64 of bloody violent games.
I don't think there are any Baphmedads to be had, but other than that, you know.
Oh, jeez, he really has lost all his Nintendo knowledge. And
I know that was in Star Fox, but it's a rare reference.
But
The reference works. Yeah. It's not perfect, but it works.
Yeah.
I don't know. The structure sounds okay to me, but my problem is, and it, you know, a lot of my knowledge of this game comes from IGN because they've basically come all over it for the past month.
Yeah, they've been like evangelizing it totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, what they've said is, even though it's kind of short, it's okay because it's really replayable because there's this hard mode that is so hard they can't actually beat the tutorial.
Yeah, that's now, exactly what that, I want in my
that
game.
That really doesn't settle it for me, you know? There's no point in there even being a hard mode if you can't play
yeah,
it.
Yeah, if it's ridiculously hard, then it doesn't make it that replayable in that. So, although I think they also said that
I'm not going to spend more than 10 minutes with it.
I think
it
also said
hard.
That the sort of it is kind of replayable in itself to some extent the new difficulty. But
I can see that.
In some ways, it kind of actually reminds me of, because I doubt, judging by the core gameplay, that I would ever enjoy it this much. So let me issue that caveat from the outset. But it kind of reminds me of some of the conversation around Sin and Punishment, because that is a short game if you just play it straight through. And, you know, that was an issue for me importing it because it was not cheap to do so. It was kind of like, you know, do you want to import a game that's Sony? But, you know, it was like, it's 5 hours long. If it were longer, I would give it a 10 or whatever, you know. And it's kind of like, oh, do I want to get this? And in the end, and that has a hard mode, which is substantially different from its normal. Yeah. And in the end, I mean, that was more than worth the purchase. So it certainly can be. You know, that general sort of like kind of structure can be rewarding, but I guess it's just if you get on with the core gameplay as much, and I kind of doubt that will be the case for me just because I'm so much.
And a lot of it comes down to personal taste and you know, your own individual approach to how you play these games. I mean, I have Sin and Punishment too, and luckily I didn't have to pay for it. It was a gift.
Yeah,
and if I had paid my own money for it, I would have been disappointed because I don't play games that way. I don't play them over and over and over and look for these tiny little variations or whatever, or try to get the highest combo. I generally don't play games in that fashion. And so for me, it would have been an issue. And I remember thinking that at the time, you know, I was like, damn, I mean, I like this game, but it's really short. And I'm glad I didn't spend $100 on it, which a lot of people did.
All right. Well, getting back to Mad World, though, as far as getting on my knees and pleading with people who listen to the show to go buy the game, I'm not. If it seems like a game you want to play, try it if you have a chance before you buy it, and if you like it, then buy it. If not, then whatever. But if I were reviewing this game, I'd probably give it, I don't know, like a solid 7.5 or an 8. It's a good game. It's a fun game.
You've had it for one day, Carl.
Hey, look,
you can't
look,
give it a score.
It's not like when I review games for the site, I play them longer for an hour anyway. I mean,
yeah, you played it for 6 months before you wrote the review back then.
No, all right.
If ever.
But no, it's a solid game from what I've played so far. It's fun. I'm not going to say, you know, get off your ass and go buy it now, but it's something to check out.
Yeah, well, I think GameSpot gave it a 7.5.
Yeah,
so
that
the,
seems
the
fair.
Praise is not.
Yeah, I mean,
but
in terms of purely the score, I mean, I don't know about the sort of shameless evangelism, but in terms of purely the score, IGN is not alone in rating it that highly. As a matter of fact,
sure.
But what I was talking about with respect to No More Heroes is kind of not so much just the open world stuff is another matter, but like even like later in the game, some of the actual sort of level parts are like, I mean, one is just a giant corridor where you don't even get to fight the boss at the end, and you know, like you go back to the baseball stadium and all that, and so it is a very heavily padded game. And so in some ways, Mad World to me, if those 5 or 6 hours it feels like condensed, would actually be preferable to my taste. But, I mean, obviously, I don't know how you can assess that when you've only played a little of it.
From what I've played so far, there's no open world, and there's no, like, you know, the enemies at least are a little bit varied from here and there, so you're not facing literally the same character model over and over again, which is nice. And so far, the boss battles have been really fun.
I mean, I'm expecting big things from the bosses, given the pedigree of the developer.
Yeah, the boss battles are very, very fun. Yeah. Also, my biggest complaint is that the camera kind of sucks. You can't really control the camera. You can just press the C button to center it.
Oh, perfect.
And also maybe I'm just stupid and I haven't figured it out yet, but so far, I haven't found a way to lock onto the enemies outside of boss battle. Maybe that's me, and maybe I'm just not.
Well,
good at
I have
it, but,
heard
you know.
That it's kind of inconsistent in how it works, so maybe that's part of it.
Could be.
Yeah.
But the other game I've been playing though is a game that I'm sure most of you guys have at least tried it. Is Street Fighter 4.
Yes.
Yes.
I have not tried it. All right, I'd like to.
Here's the thing: I am the furthest thing from a fighting game enthusiast. You know, the most hardcore I get is like the Naruto Clash of Ninja games. And it was only because I reviewed them. But this Street Fighter 4 is amazing. Like, literally, my roommate picked it up, and we probably put, like, 80 hours into that game. It's just...
80?
80, really?
80. It's only been out a couple weeks, man.
Dude, it's been out since the middle
get
of...
Get some sleep.
It's been out for, like, 3 or 4 weeks, and we play it, like, literally, like, a few hours every day. So, dude, it's 80 is hyperbole, but you get what I mean. And, yeah. It's just really fantastic. Like, all the characters control great. I mean, it's more so
have
than, like...
Have you got a stick to use, or sticks...
No, we are the poor masses who are using the Xbox analog stick.
And it's the Xbox one as well. Oh, dear.
Well, it's not like I'm using the D-pad. I'm just using the analog
yeah,
stick.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
It's, well, you know,
yeah.
I had the chance to go buy a stick, and I was thinking, I just cannot justify paying $50 to use for one game.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. I mean, that's what's nice about with Tatsunoko versus Capcom. The classic controller D-pad is good enough that you don't really feel it necessary to get a stick. Whereas I guess with the 360 D-pad, that really is more of an issue.
Definitely.
For people that wouldn't want to use the analog stick.
And
well,
yeah.
You know, there is like a special edition 360 controller that's being sold. It's only about 30 or 40 bucks, so it's cheaper than any of the arcade sticks. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a Saturn controller.
Oh yeah,
so it has the two rows of three buttons on the right. Mm-hmm. And then on the I don't even think it has joysticks at all. Mm-hmm. But it has like a redone D-pad that is I don't know, I haven't heard anything bad about it, so I assume it's pretty good. I'm sure it's much better than the standard 360 D-pad, but how could it not be?
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, no, Street Fighter 4 has just been really great fun. We unlocked all the characters in, like, the first couple days. And the reason that I know it's a fighting game for me is because I've learned the moves. And usually for a fighting game with me, it just comes down to button mashing. Because I don't have the patience to learn, like, dial-a-combo moves. But with Street Fighter 4, like, I can pull off all the ultras for all of the characters pretty easily. So that's saying a lot. You know, I'm far, far away from being Ty Sugar when it comes to fighting games.
It is a little bit easier to pull off combos in this mm-hmm. game than what, you know, you had to do in 2
definitely,
Turbo,
yeah. Absolutely,
Alpha,
yeah.
Alpha 2 Turbo.
Yeah, those games, I can't get into them. They're just too complex for me. So if you're a fan of simplifying something down, get Street Fighter 4.
Yeah, it was kind of it was a little bit less of a learning experience than it is on the other games, which is mm-hmm. fine if you want to just get into it, whereas if you wanted to just go through the whole process of getting your butt kicked constantly until you get good,
yeah.
you probably won't get that here.
Definitely not. But yeah, that's basically what I've been playing.
Alrighty. So I'll go next. I've been playing a hell of a lot of Puzzle Quest Galactrix,
nice.
Which is not shitty, as you may have read on certain websites. It's very, very, very similar to the first one mm-hmm. in terms of structure, pacing, the shittiness of the DS code.
Is it loading?
It's got load times, graphical lag,
great
audio bugs. I mean, all this stuff was pretty much in the first one. The load times are worse.
And if this follows the pedigree or the progression of the previous
the Wii
one,
version will be
yeah, the Wii version
unplayable.
Will be even worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Johnny, are they going to be releasing this on Xbox Live Arcade like they did for the last one?
Well, it is coming downloadable to the PS3 and 360.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. That's probably
they
what I'll play
now. They have announced
that?
Okay, I don't remember that. But that's cool. I never got the original on 360 just because I already had it on DS, and that's it's going to be the same for this one. But, you know, the nice thing about on DS is it is portable, and... it's the kind of game you can pretty much play while you're watching TV or, you know, whatever, listening to a podcast or something like that.
Or Talk 112 if you like. Nah.
There you go. But it's really good. You know, it's very similar and really, other than the sci-fi setting, which I could take or leave, I don't mind it, but it doesn't do a whole lot for me, you know, but it actually probably does a little more for me than the fantasy crap did in the first one. But the main difference is just the, you know, the puzzle field is a different shape, the puzzle pieces are a different shape, and you have gravity coming in from six different directions. So that's really the only truly, you know, key difference between the two games. And I think it's a good difference. I know it's a bit of personal preference, and I can understand why some people are going to prefer the original way of doing it, which is more like Bejeweled. But I'm finding that as I spend more and more time, and I'm probably getting up to around 10 hours at this point, as I spend more time playing Galactrix, I get more used to it. And I think it has a pretty similar learning curve to the first one. You know, as you spend more time with it, you start to identify certain patterns on the board. You start to think about different strategic measures that you can take. You start to unlock more weapons, and those can affect your battle strategy significantly. And you know, and you level up, so certain things become a little easier, a little less annoying, like random encounters. As you play through the game, they become less of a problem, at least so far it seems to be the case. So I think it is a game that rewards your patience and persistence with it, at the point where I'm at right now, it's very addictive, and I'm really enjoying it, and I wish I was playing it right now.
Nice. Oh, thank you very much.
But, no, it's certainly not an incredibly well-done game. Like I said, there's a lot of technical problems with it, but I think it's still very, very compelling, you know, it's pretty much as good as the first one. So if you like the first puzzle quest and you're willing to deal with a lot of mechanical changes to how the battles play out, then I think you'll enjoy it, you know. If you've never played Puzzle Quest and you're expecting Bejeweled and you hate Bejeweled anyway because you're really a fan of Panel de Pon, then you might hate this, and you probably shouldn't be reviewing it in the first place. The other game I've been playing is Black for Xbox. I rented this. And Black is you know, a game by Criterion. They make Burnout, and they used to make Renderware. I don't think they do anymore.
This game basically got a lot of press because it was supposed to have a really good graphics engine where you could destroy shit, right?
It does. It still looks really good. And in fact, I was surprised when I saw the title screen. The copyright on this is 2006, so this is like a very late Xbox game.
Yeah,
it was out on PS2 as well.
It was one of the last major Xbox titles because Microsoft very much killed the Xbox.
Yeah.
And I was really curious about it when it you know, when it first came out, but I didn't have an Xbox, and I didn't really want to play it on PS2 just because I heard that that version was much less impressive. So if you play it on PS2, you're kind of losing what made the game notable in the first place, right?
Right.
So now I can play it on backwards compatibility, and so I rented it, and I'm enjoying it so far. I haven't had a lot of time with it, but it seems to be, in a lot of ways, a pretty straightforward first-person shooter. In terms of gameplay, it doesn't do a whole lot to distinguish itself, but the graphics are absolutely gorgeous. I mean, they still look good, even compared to a 360 game. You know, they're not high-def, but the modeling and the lighting and everything is really well done. I think it has absolutely excellent sound design. The voices, the sound effects, and the music are really incredible. Unfortunately, the AI is pretty bad. Sometimes you'll see like two soldiers, and you'll pop a headshot at one of them and put him down, and the other will just kind of keep walking.
Nonchalant, just like, yeah, it's easy.
Yeah, and the guns are extremely loud. The sound effects are cranked up really high relative to the overall volume, and even then, you can shoot guns sometimes really close to enemies, and they don't even look at you. And they just, it's like they just don't hear it. So there are some problems with the AI.
I've heard it speculated with this game, and you know, I knew a lot of people who actually own this game, that the game is kind of dumbed down because of the immense strain the graphics engine puts on the system.
It, you know, that wouldn't really surprise me. The graphics are that good.
Yeah, it is really stunning. Because I remember when it came out, it was really close to 360 coming out.
Yeah.
And I was just surprised that that wasn't a 360 game.
Yeah, I think this probably looks better than some of those early 360 games.
Easily. Easily.
There were real junkers early on with that system. But I don't really have anything else to say about it. But I do kind of feel like, you know, even though the gameplay is a little bit standard, run-of-the-mill, it's still really fun, and I'm enjoying it. And I think, you know, since Criterion's done kind of a pretty strong string of Burnout games lately, and it seems like they're not terribly interested in iterating on Burnout Paradise. They'd prefer to just keep upgrading it and selling the original game, which is cool. It's an interesting and innovative strategy. I hope that, you know, they're actually working on a new title that's maybe in a different series, and I would love to see a sequel to Black on the current systems, because I think it's a very strong basis for a franchise that you know, they could do some really cool things with it if they try to do another one.
I actually remember hearing a while back about there being a rumor about them developing a new Black. So.
There was a Black 2 rumor.
Yeah, so yeah. Maybe there's some truth to that.
I think it started floating around in late 07.
And also, those of you who don't have Gamefly like Johnny does or don't have a place to rent games, Black is available on the Xbox like originals on mm-hmm. Xbox Live, so you can buy it there cool. if you like. Yeah.
$15, yeah. I mean, for certain games, the Xbox originals pricing is a bit out of hand, but for some games, it's probably a pretty good deal. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's my new business. James, I heard that you haven't really had time to play anything.
Yeah, basically all I've been focused on is site stuff.
And Street Fighter 4.
And a little Street Fighter 4. and of course, Eternal Darkness.
Mm. So I guess you're working hard on all the anniversary articles.
Well, I have to say that John Lindemann, although he's not here today, has been a real champ on that, and so has TYP.
Mm-hmm. Can I just take a moment and say that I've been reading those articles, and they are great.
Cool.
So,
thank you for saying
that. Very, very well done, guys.
And I think at this point, we're up to 03 tonight, which is in dire need of someone to do something, and I'm the only one around, so it's gonna be a long night.
I did 2002, and I had a lot of fun. It brought back a lot of crazy memories, and I even got to dig up some old photos from E3 that year.
Yeah.
You know, 2002 was just a ridiculous year for GameCube. Yeah, I didn't even realize how dense it was until I went back through it. And
that's kind of the way it's been working on these, because you'd be like, oh, shit, that happened, didn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
To go a little inside baseball on this one, TYP and I were working on 2000, which was the space world where they unveiled the GameCube. So E3 was pretty tame. There was some good N64 stuff.
Cool. Yeah, that was a great year for N64.
But in terms of GameCube news, there was really nothing.
No.
The news basically was that you weren't going to get to see anything there.
The news was that Matt Casamassina had a Gecko chip in his pocket at the IGN.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
That's pretty much the only thing I saw about Dolphin that year.
Yeah.
I could just picture Matt like at an E3 party, like, hey, you want to see what I got in my pocket? Check it out.
Oh, yeah.
But
he had a beer in one hand and a Gecko in the other.
But the Space World was its big coming out party, and we didn't, you know, everybody knows about that famous Zelda video, the one that had massive repercussions for the franchise for at least half a decade. Because you could say that video is the reason why Twilight Princess had to look the way it did.
Yeah.
So you could, what's that, 6 years?
Well, it does look substantially different from
right,
it, because
those
were the Smash Brothers models, basically, in terms of the art. Whereas Twilight Princess is actually quite significantly more detailed.
Yes, it is. The tone of the art style.
Yeah, the general not being a cartoon.
Right.
Well, it's more than that. I think you know, most people consider Twilight Princess to be Nintendo's attempt to not apologize for Wind Waker, but to try to
recapture Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
It is that, but at the same time, it's also kind of a nod to all the people who were disappointed that the Space World 2000 Zelda didn't come.
Right.
I mean, that's a way to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's six years? Basically 6 years that video had a repercussion on the franchise. So, but when we started talking about it, we didn't realize how many other vaporware videos there were for the GameCube that year.
There always are.
Two other ones that we can name that were aired in the same presentation.
I sure was looking forward to Meowth's Party.
This Meowth's Party.
Who ever believed that was anything but just, you know, nonsense?
Look, it made sense because at the time Mario Party was a massive franchise for them. And they weren't even making it. They were shipping it off to Hudson, and every year Hudson was sending them a big fat check. So it would almost make sense that they would make one based on the Pokemon franchise, which was very,
when
very
was there hot. Ever any indication that him mucking about with a guitar meant a board game?
Well, I don't know. I mean, party game was still a very loosely defined term at that point. So I mean, the idea they could do a party game with a very, very hot franchise, because Pokemon was really hot at that point.
Well, I mean, still is.
Well, I mean, then it was still in that really absurd phase of popularity.
Yeah.
So it would... You know, it would have made sense. And then we had the Mario 128 on there. Well, with the exception of Meowth's Party, Mario 128 also had a pretty long legs.
See, again, I mean, that was, for me, I always assumed that was just a tech demo. But later...
It didn't look like a game.
But they started...
Miyamoto kind of made these indications that it was more than that, or that it could have been more than that.
Well,
you know,
in fact, he didn't... he didn't acknowledge that it was no longer a game in development until 07.
Well, that's just Nintendo's style.
He was still referring to it as a game in 06. Well,
we know that Mario 128, basically, it kind of spawned off two games based
Pikmin,
on that demo.
Yeah,
Pikmin and Mario Galaxy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it was about how many characters can we put on the screen and how do you deal with these group dynamics
and that was
of controlling all these characters at the same time. That became Pikmin. And the other idea was all these guys were on a sphere running around. Mm-hmm. How do you build a platform Mario-style game out of... having this localized gravity field and small objects to run around on, and obviously that became Galaxy. So, that's the way Nintendo works. Things like Stage Debut, I mean, go back and look at some of the pictures of Stage Debut, that turned into the Mii channel for Wii 10 years later.
Perfect.
You know?
That's timely and informative development. Yeah, it also I'm quite shocked at how well-traveled our staff was back in the day. Billy went to Space World, where if you have the opportunity, you need to go check the 2000 article, page 3, because there's Billy with what might be the worst Captain Falcon cosplayer in the history of any cosplay ever. And I don't know who gave the caption to that image, but it's perfect.
Alrighty, well, we need to move on. Greg's going to wrap up new business for us.
Yeah, well, before I get to what I've been playing this week, I have to raise an issue with Carl. We mentioned earlier that there's the top five lists are a sort of feature on his podcast, Talk 112. And in the most recent episode, as of recording, episode 9,
they did
top five websites. And what website was not even mentioned as an aside was Nintendo World Report. What's going on, Carl?
In all honesty, I'll tell you why I didn't say NWR. Because there's that. But there's also when we were coming up with that list before we do the top five. And again, this is a little inside baseball for a different baseball. But basically, before we do our top five, we kind of all talk to each other about what we want to talk about, and so we don't have like too many. Sites that cross over among different people. And one of my other guys, John, said, well, do you want to throw in Nintendo World Report? And I'm like, yeah, I definitely could. But at the same time, I feel like that's a little bit cheating just because I worked for Nintendo World Report.
It was too on the nose, right?
Yeah, like, I just
could
just
have
like,
just had the acknowledgement, just say, well, I'm not included this.
On multiple episodes of Talk 112, because you guys were so nice to do that commercial for us, to put on the commercial to one of your shows, we have thanked the entire cast of Radio Free Nintendo multiple times on the show for that.
And also in this episode...
Yeah, thanks, asshole.
Carl, thanks someone for sending in an email who is one of our emailers. That's Andy.
Yes, one of Andy's. Perfect. Nice, awesome dude, Andy. Yeah, he's a great guy.
So,
nice.
Yeah.
Send in more questions, Andy.
We made you, Carl. We can unmake you.
Oh, nice. Shit.
Carl's going to wind up dead in a Tallahassee water reserve.
More accurately, the next time you send over a commercial, I will replace it with 90 seconds of whale noises, finished with an abrupt Carl sucks at the end.
Endless Ocean 2?
I think that was on the last Sigur Rós album.
Anyways, let's get on to our new business, huh? Come on.
Yeah,
games.
I picked up Lynx crossbow training off eBay, so I didn't have to get the zapper.
You didn't get the zapper?
I commend your valor, sir.
Yeah, that was the whole point of getting it off
to
eBay.
To avoid getting the zapper?
Wait. So you bought the game off eBay to avoid getting a piece of plastic you could easily have disposed of?
Mm-hmm. Well, because it makes it quite a lot cheaper to get it that way.
Really? People are willing to pay that much for the zapper?
Well, yeah, believe it or not, James, some people buy that unit at the store because they want the zapper. And
yeah,
not the
exactly. No, that's why there's a lot of copies of Link's Crossbow trading on eBay.
So they're happy to get rid of it.
Because basically people sell on the game and keep the zapper.
That's
Yeah, well, that's what eBay's for. Facilitate. Want the zapper. I want the game. There you go.
Capitalism.
Mutually beneficial.
And for those of you in the States who want to get Link's Crossbow training, you can get it at GameStop now used for like $1.99.
Are you on the take?
Look, all I'm saying is they sell great products at low, low prices.
No, if it's a dollar, I might go pick that up next time
$1.
I go there.
It's like $1.99. I mean, what have you got to lose, really?
$1.99.
Other than $1.99.
2.5 hours.
So yeah, by getting it there in that way, I basically got it for like half of what you'd have to pay on the most economical Zapper deal, and that left it about the same price as 1,000 Wii points are over here, which is kind of appropriate in some ways. So yeah, playing the game, you've got three different distinct sort of modes. You've got the one that's pure shooting gallery, where you know you kind of just your viewpoint is entirely fixed. Targets pop up, you got to shoot them. You've got then got the one where you kind of your position is fixed, but you sort of third person, and you can sort of use the remote, like, you know, you've got the kind of bounding box kind of set up where as you sort of get to the edge of the screen, your view starts to turn and you're shooting stuff that's kind of all around you. And then the last one is the, I think it's called the Ranger mode or something, where it's kind of almost a bit RE4-ish, except you can actually move and shoot at the same time. And a first thing I would say is the tracking really isn't smooth enough for it to, like, seriously mimic a light gun game. You know, in terms of, like, really feel like you are literally pointing at a part of the screen and shooting it, which kind of makes
Well, it would if you were playing it with a zapper.
That's what it's there for.
You know what I mean? That's what's so silly about it, though, is that, you know, it's in no way... You know, from what you hear about stuff like Ghost Squad and some of these other games, like, it sounds like they are more sort of... They do more replicate a light gun experience. And yeah, this is kind of the whole point of that, is to put it in this shell and all this stuff. And it really doesn't, because it's so kind of the crosshair kind of is a little sticky, if you know what I mean, as it moves across you. It's not perfectly smooth, and therefore you would really want to see that, as you know, you wouldn't want to be able to, if you can't turn it off, but say for instance if you could, you know, which you can in some of these other light gun games, you know, you'd be kind of missing out on the fact that it doesn't quite track right. So I mean that's not great, but it doesn't really affect the gameplay when you're just playing it normally. And the way the scoring system works is that you've got combos based on, like, consecutive hits, and the multiplier just goes up and up and up. I mean, you know, if you have 30 consecutive hits, it's times 30. So, in a way, it kind of encourages you to be a little conservative, because, obviously, you know, if you go for something, a shot that's a little more challenging and you miss, that's really going to cost you a lot of points. Because then the multiplier goes back to, you know, back to one, and then you've got to build it all the way up again. But on the other hand, you've only got a certain length of time, so therefore, if the more targets you can pick off in that time, the greater your score is going to be. So that kind of balances out a bit, I guess. If you go for like really high scores, you're probably going to start off just focusing on maintaining your multiplier, and then gradually widen out how many targets you can kind of pick off using that multiplier. Although in certain situations, like there's ones where you're like surrounded by skeletons and stuff, and that really kind of, you know, it feels like you should just be more like, you know, taking everything out at will, but then you very much will lose the multiplier in that scenario, so that kind of mixes it up a bit. And the other thing I want to mention about is just how it uses Twilight Princess. It's a shame that it doesn't use more of the universe that's there. Because, I mean, they've used certain settings multiple times. There's multiple stuff in the desert. There's multiple stuff in Hyrule Fields. Multiple stuff in, was it Ordon, the town that he comes from originally. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that goes unused, like anything related to the Twilight at all, like whether it's within Hyrule or eventually the Twilight Realm itself isn't in there. There's nothing related to Zant or Ganondorf or any of that sort of stuff. That's kind of disappointing, really. You may as well make the full use out of it. I mean, the whole point is that you've already got these places.
Would you rather they have gone with the original plot plan of
the futuristic
time warp that drops a weapon in Hyrule and then the alien?
No, but my question was, but I mean, if the weapon was dropped in from the future, then he'd still be in Hyrule, so it wouldn't really change all that much. Whereas, like, if he got sucked into the future, then that'd change everything.
That'd be amazing. Hercules guess, in New York.
Unfortunately, they have... It's Hercules in New York. Did you just say that? Did I just hear that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that movie is unbelievable. That is one
or
of the
Beastmaster 2.
That is one of the funniest things in the world. Well, if you hear the version without, when it's not dubbed, of course. Because that's where the fun really comes in.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to look for that.
No, there is a version where you can actually hear Arnie saying, "Zoas, I have been willful."
Oh, my God.
Epic beyond words.
It was his first film, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. It's
after Pumping Iron, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Brilliant.
Major tangent. But I mean, Lynx crossbow training, it sounds like it might be worth $2.
It might be worth $2. Way to go, Nintendo.
I'm pretty happy with it for, you know, cheap price, because it is, it's still, to the extent that there is some cool kind of use made of some of the Zelda stuff. Like, some of the scenarios are, like, really very much, like, ripped straight out of the game in terms of, like, the protecting the carriage. Do you remember that on horseback?
It's my least favorite part of Twilight Princess.
Yeah, well, it works a lot better as a shooter. You know what I mean? It's
okay.
Actually, like,
I can see that.
Really, you know, because that bit just didn't really work, did it? Because it's kind of clumsy. And whereas obviously with this, you know, you just sort of, you know, you're having to look continually, sort of look around and pick off the little goblin guys off their mounts. And the bit where you have to sort of kill them in that sort of old western type hidden village. Like, you've got that sort of recreated and stuff. So some of it's very much, like, just ripped straight out, but in a way kind of, like, better, because the gameplay's kind of more set up for it, those kind of parts. And that's nice. And then there's a boss battle where, the you know, the Templar time we fight the knight at the sort of top, that sort of swordsman.
Oh, yeah.
Or is it, I forget what they're called, but, you know, like, he's got, like, if you gradually sort of take away his armor and then he throws the sword at you and starts sort of jumping around and all that kind of stuff. You kind of play that with the crossbow, which is kind of weird, but, like, he has explosive arrows, which actually blow the armor off the guy and stuff. So, there's some cool use, but I just think they could have done more. Like, you know, I mean, obviously, like, the final battle or something, they could have done something with, but they didn't, or Zant, or a lot of things.
You know, this is really just the warm-up for the upcoming Zelda on-rails shooter.
In the future.
Inevitable.
Twilight Princess 2.
In the future. With the future.
Because that's when they'll actually be able to be bothered to, like, make the new assets for
right,
the future.
Right, see the reason
that was the only obstacle. I thought, the plot is totally sound.
No,
we would have to do new assets.
It got shelved because the plot was so totally sound. It needed to be saved for a full game.
Alrighty, well, we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back with Retroactive Eternal Darkness Edition. Retroactive discussion. We're finally talking about Eternal Darkness Sanity's Requiem, the illustrious GameCube title from Silicon Knights, the first of two that they made for the system. And, you know, where do we start? I don't know. Have we all played it before this?
Well, actually, this is my first time playing through the game. I've played it before a little. A friend of mine brought a copy up at the end of 2002, played through some of the early bits of that, and I thought, oh, I shall have to get this at some point, and I didn't. And then I did eventually get a copy couple of years ago, and then started playing it, and then just got lost in the shuffle. So this is actually the first time that I've really come back and played through it. For the I should say I'm only about halfway through the game, I think.
At this point. I think I am. Too.
I haven't played it as much as I would have liked over the last, because we've had quite a while at this point.
Yeah, and it's a decently long game. I think it clocks in around 10 or 12 hours.
Yeah. I'll put out the disclaimer that my experience with Eternal Darkness, I played about halfway through in 2006. So some of my stuff might be a little rusty, but I'll just put that out there in the meantime.
And Carl was like, "This isn't Killer 7. I hate it."
Fool me once, but no.
I've played it 5 or 6 times in the past.
Yeah, this is I think I played it about 3.5 times, maybe. And yeah, so this would be my 4th, basically. But I'm definitely a big fan of this game, and I have been since the first time I ever heard of it, basically. I got to play it in 2000 on 64, which was really cool, and I was a little disappointed when I heard that they were porting it to GameCube, because I was like, well, that basically equals over a year delay. Mm-hmm. In the end, it is, there's a lot... It does a lot with the GameCube hardware that benefits the game and the storytelling, but it definitely looks like
an N64
game. It shows its N64 heritage. Yeah. I don't want to say it doesn't look like an N64 game by any means.
No, it doesn't.
But
no.
In certain character models, I think, and in certain aspects of it, I think the way that the enemy parts are highlighted in combat is a little antiquated looking at this point. It's just a little gaudy. But yeah, I think there are certain elements of it that you can kind of tell that it got caught up in a platform transition. But for the most part, it's a very nice GameCube title in terms of production values and everything.
I think in terms of the environments that it created, was probably above and beyond what we expected from games at the time.
Oh yeah, beautiful.
Not just beautiful, but varied. It was because they had to get all these themes in there, and the fact they were able to revisit sites and yet somehow still make them seem different but easily recognizable. So a good example is the tower stages. So where were those? They were in Babylon, right?
The tower. You're talking about like with Khmer,
yes.
And then later on you have Michael the firefighter guy, right?
Right, but there's still elements of it you recognize, and because the history is not totally linear. It is with respect to those stages, I suppose, but it is kind of interesting to see these stages change.
I'm like I said to the guys, when we weren't recording, I'm probably going to be the one who likes the game the least. But there are a lot of things that should be praised about the game. One thing that stood out to me the first time I played it was that that French citadel,
where the church.
The church, where you visited that first time, and then you come back later. I think it's Paul who goes back. Mm-hmm. Is that and you go back, and you see how time has just ravaged it or changed it. And I remember seeing it in an interview where I think in the original version of that church there was stained glass, and then Dennis Dyack had heard that stained glass hadn't been invented yet, so they removed it. So
sticklers for historical stuff. And I really like that attention to detail. I like that a lot of these stages take place in parts of the world where you've never really played a game that was set there, and in periods of time that aren't typically chosen as settings for video games. And what I like about this is really something that I like about all Eternal Darkness games, except maybe for Twin Snakes, since it was a remake. They didn't have much control over it. But I think the background research that they do on their games is really impressive. And the worlds that they create, the mythologies that they create, a lot of it is sort of in the background. It's not the upfront story, but it's just the peripheral stuff. It's so detailed and amazing. And really interesting. It's not easy to ignore because it's so cool. You want to learn more about it, and I really really enjoy that. And unfortunately, going back, I think that part shines a lot better than the actual dialogue. I mean, the plot is pretty good. I have certain complaints about the plot, but I think the plot is generally pretty impressive. But the actual script writing is flimsy in certain areas. Mm. There are certain lines people say that just don't sound good. It's like nobody would ever say that.
Yeah.
As Kareem has some awful, awful lines.
It was from the outset, and there was actually almost like an admission of this in the script, but the whole idea of Alex seeing the dismembered body of a granddad was just so ridiculous. It's just like, oh yeah, oh no, I'm afraid you have to see it because it hasn't got a head. No, that's why you wouldn't see it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You know, I mean, come on. I mean, that.
Yeah,
and they actually, she actually says, "Why are you showing me this?"
exactly. So it's
kind of like they are kind of admitting this a bit of a cheat, but still, it just, you know, as a sort of like kicking off like the sort of dramatic part of the game, the cutscenes, that was not a good foot to get off on. As
no,
far as
no.
I was concerned.
But
this is a huge complaint I have with Too Human, is that the world they created and the background and the history of the
it's
characters,
all the game
all
has
this
going
stuff
for
is
it.
It's all awesome, and then the actual dialogue is awful.
Yeah,
it's like they really need to hire a real scriptwriter who can make these things not sound awkward.
Because the Silicon Knights does everything in house, doesn't it? Presumably that would include the script, and they come up somewhat short, apparently.
Yeah, and they just need somebody to look over their shoulder and say,
no, that
part's not good
enough.
Stupid. You need to rewrite that line. It's too bad because, you know, they've got great voice actors who are having to read some pretty terrible lines of dialogue.
Well, I know, for me, I straight away recognized when I played it back in late 2002 or 2003, whatever it was. The voice of Alex is Jennifer Hale, who's quite famous for doing video voiceover now, because I think she's done stuff for Metal Gear and all that sort of stuff. But I remember from, she played Felicia Hardy in the Spider-Man animated series from the mid-90s. I'll always remember her voice from. She's pretty good. I really think she's very good in the game and generally.
Mm-hmm. I think most of the voice acting is great.
Yeah.
And apparently she also provides some of the sort of utterances and grunts of Samus, which is seems
really
curious. Seems kind of erotic, really.
Is what it seems.
From the
so I think one thing that about this game that I thought was kind of, I don't want to use the word impressive, but unique, was how it managed to keep these characters around even after it effectively disposed of them. Because most game creators, they get kind of protective of the characters they work hard on, so you never really see a main character get killed, or even like an important character. You might see them get killed for dramatic effect, but you can usually see this character is going to die. You can tell. But they put a lot of effort into characters so they could dispose of them, but yet they kept bringing them around and
it is kind of interesting. You know, they set up these characters, and then generally unpleasant things tend to happen to them at the end of the chapters. It's thing I was wondering as you get further into the game: is there a sense of sort of the formality of the unpleasant end that they're going to reach? You know, it's kind
of
like
not necessarily. What happens is sometimes the game surprises you, and that a character doesn't die, and something terrible doesn't happen at the end.
Well, I think
that's good, because you know the point
really
I'm at, I'm kind
wondering.
Of like, this is kind of. This works now, but if it's going to be so many more chapters,
I would say a fair number of them meet unpleasant ends.
Sure, and that's in fitting with the story, basically.
Yeah,
just a gimmick.
I'm trying to think of who doesn't die.
Because it kind of recalls to me, in some ways, the horror anthology movies where, like, you know, somebody's reading like from a book or something, and they kind of go as she kind of is in this, and you know, it's kind of like each one is punctuated with some unpleasant end. It's a bit like that, although much less hokey than those movies usually are.
Yeah, you're talking about Tales from the Hood or something like that.
Yeah, there's loads of them. I think there was one that was Lovecraft themed that I saw. I think it was called Necronomicon, one of the three worst films I've ever seen. So Eternal Darkness is definitely a vast, vast upgrade and a much better sort of plundering of the Lovecraft style than that piece of terrible stuff.
One thing I think that really, you know, hampered my enjoyment of Eternal Darkness, because I had heard so much about it. Like, I've heard so... It's so great. I asked some people on the staff what they thought of it. I think I actually asked Johnny about it. He's like, you need to play this game now. So I went out and got, I think it was like $4.99 at GameStop. Great prices. Great prices, great games. And I got it. And the thing though, that really, I feel like I would have liked it more if I hadn't played Resident Evil 4 before this game.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Because
Is that really pertinent? I mean,
it depends if you go in with the mindset of comparing it to Resident Evil, because if you do, then in 2002, this was mind-blowing. I mean, if you think about the state of Resident Evil in 2002, Eternal Darkness was light years ahead of anything
for me playing it now, I would say the thing about it, obviously I've played Resident Evil 4 and all that at this point, but to me it doesn't really seem that relevant. I mean, I think where Eternal Darkness seems to more sort of comfortably occupy the space towards the adventure game side, whereas Resident Evil isn't really an adventure game.
It had certain aspirations towards being an adventure game,
it didn't have the intricacies of Eternal Darkness, like with the magic and the items and stuff. It was very much more simple. But you had the tank controls, the action wasn't really that good yet, and of course like the voice acting was not in any way credible. So like Resident Evil I thought was a bit more of an awkward hybrid back pre-4. Now obviously 4 goes in the action direction, and then really solidifies itself that way, whereas I think Eternal Darkness is primarily an adventure game as far as I'm concerned.
If you're going to discuss that sort of awkwardness of the pre-4 Resident Evils, Resident Evil Zero should have never come out as it was, because I think at that point it was so dated and so terrible and so completely unplayable
that was the review consensus, someone should have hit the stop button
and been like, this game must be destroyed, every copy of
right.
it erased.
Yeah, and honestly I was very much not a fan of Resident Evil until RE4, so
yeah, same,
for me
same.
Eternal Darkness was a really nice, you know, breath of fresh air, in that it obviously bore certain similarities to Resident Evil, but at the same time, it didn't have any of the shit that made RE so bad back then.
There are other survival horror games, but let's go through the ones that existed at that point. So you had... there was
Dino Crisis.
Except there's Capcom ones that are the same shit. So you have... Yeah. So Dino Crisis is just Resident Evil with dinosaurs. Let's put that aside.
Clock Tower.
There's Clock Tower, which it
doesn't really matter, because Eternal Darkness is not survival horror. But it does matter
because that's what it was compared to.
It was compared to that because it looked like Resident Evil.
Yeah, exactly. I find that is a facile comparison and not particularly
useful.
It's
still a take on a theme, though.
I mean, I think there's certain elements of it that it does owe to Resident Evil.
Right.
You know, and we used to ask Dennis about this all the time, and he said, look... He would say, I'm a big fan of Resident Evil, but Eternal Darkness is a different kind of game. And he's absolutely right. It is a different kind of game. Any similarities are superficial, I think.
His fandom of Resident Evil is made immediately apparent if you try to play Too Human with its massive decision to make cameras look at giant statues instead of the action.
No, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the camera system in Eternal Darkness is one of the best I've ever seen. And it's not perfect. There are moments when it can cause you problems, and there are times when you're, especially if you're in Angkor Thom and you're trying to navigate this very large temple, and the second time you go to it, it can get a little disorienting as to, have I been in this hallway yet, or am I supposed to go this way or that way? Did I come from that way? But that aside, I think the camera works incredibly well, because it does a really good job of following your character. It usually stays out of the way. It usually does not cause problems in combat, although there are occasional times when it does. But for the most part, it lets you see what you need to see, and you never have to manage it. I mean, you can't manage it, but that's okay, because it manages itself so well.
Right.
Yeah, because it's not static, but it's sort of fixed position a lot of the time, or it's sort of on a set track.
But this is coming back to comparing it to what was out at the time. It was loads better than this sort of static pre-rendered backgrounds or the camera being locked right behind you.
It's nowhere near as obtuse as something that you would find in, like, I don't know, Resident Evil game.
But even not just a Resident Evil, where you could deal with something like a Tomb Raider game, where the camera is like an epileptic child. It could be stuck behind you, it could be stuck at a corner, it could be flinging itself off in some random direction.
Yeah, I'm sure that if Carl circa 2002 had played it, he would have had a much better time than 2006. It was just the fact that I bought it thinking, oh, okay, well, I really love Resident Evil 4. This game sounds interesting. I wonder if it'll be not too much, like, more dated than Resident Evil 4.
Maybe it hasn't the faintest thing to do
with Resident Evil 4. Exactly. And then that was kind of the letdown of, like, oh, this is there are things that I really like about this, and there are things that I can respect about this, mm-hmm. but it wasn't the experience I was hoping for.
So, I mean, they, like I said, those sure. really those really split off from the sort of hybrid of Resident Evil, the yeah. early Resident Evils, in completely opposite directions. I mean,
but yeah, like I said, I completely know why everyone loves this game, and there are a lot, like I said, there are a lot of things that I respect about it, and it's definitely a game that's crafted with a lot of love.
Yeah.
You know, and it, you know what? It's a damn good game, you know?
Crafted with a lot of love.
Yeah, you got me.
Nice and I'm there. Sure, and I'm sure a lot of there's a lot of that was Nintendo guiding Silicon Knight's hand.
I think they did this a lot of this on their own. I think they put they were the ones who were really up on this game versus Nintendo. I think Nintendo probably would have been willing to let them just sort of do what they wanted to do.
Well,
here.
I can. I mean, I talked with Dennis for hours and hours about Eternal Darkness back when it was coming out or about to come out, and you know, we asked him a lot about, you know, what is Nintendo's involvement? And this is back when he would say things like, you know, you shouldn't even think of us as a second party. You should think of us as a first party because we're that close with Nintendo, et cetera. But, yeah. But, you know, a lot of what Nintendo did was they basically produced the game from afar. So it was similar to what Nintendo did with Metroid Prime. They would come in and look at it. People like Miyamoto would play it and give suggestions, and a lot of it was really fine-tuning things. It was like, okay, can we make the control smoother here? Can we, you know, I think Silicon Knights put in the targeting for combat, but Nintendo said, why don't you highlight the body part so that it's more obvious, you know, especially in these dark environments, it can be difficult to see where you're actually aiming at. So why don't you highlight the body part? There were, I think the camera is primarily a Silicon Knights thing because they are really obsessed with that sort of thing. But probably a lot of the way the puzzles are put together intuitively, I think Nintendo probably had a positive influence on that aspect of the game. But in terms of the storytelling and things like that, that's all Silicon Knights. That's really their specialty.
I would have thought so,
So Nintendo's, they were more of the polish experts. You know, they wanted to make it feel like a Nintendo game. And short of the save system, I think they did a great job. The save system, and I probably have a forum post about this, but yeah, actually I do. It's from Dasmos. And Dasmos posted, so I played this for like 2 hours and got to some Amazon area with some chick. I then died. I hadn't saved at all yet, but I figured it wouldn't matter. But after I died, it didn't give me any option to continue from where I was, and I ended up going back to the title screen having to start from scratch. And, you know,
yeah.
and he actually went on to say that he basically didn't want to play the game anymore. This was his first mm-hmm. time with it. And he was basically asking people to help motivate him to try it again because he was so frustrated.
You know,
it's a shame.
I had an experience like that with this game because when it was new, when I bought my GameCube, there were no memory cards available, first party memory cards available, because mm-hmm. for whatever reason, people would buy 5 GameCube controllers and like 9 memory cards when they bought their.
Well,
GameCube.
They were so tiny, they were worried about.
Yeah, I know,
space.
But yeah. but still, it was like. Like, they didn't restock their supply for them either. It was very weird. Like, it was hard to get a memory card for the longest time.
Got my 59s, yo.
So, yeah. I've got, like, 659.
Stocking up.
It's absurd. But I had this giant, like, 500-block third-party thing.
Hell.
Those things were notorious.
Yeah, I had one of those from Mad Catz, and one day it decided that it didn't want to be a memory card anymore. And it took away all of my games.
You have the same model I have.
Oh, dear God.
But, and
I remember at one point EA released a sports game that the save file was larger than the largest currently available first-party memory card. So you had to buy a third-party card to play it with. And the third-party cards were all terrible. They were infamous
I didn't have the Mad Catz one. I had one that started with an N. I can't remember the company's name.
Oh, Nyko?
Newbie.
Yeah,
Nyko,
yeah, who was actually supposed to be notorious for being even worse. It failed on me at one point, but it wasn't a huge deal at the time because I really wasn't playing any games on it. But I put Eternal Darkness on it, and there's an insanity effect where the game fails and the memory card gets deleted.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the exact same screen as the real one. And having already seen that...
You must have freaked out.
I did, because I was very near the end of the game. I didn't play the game for 4 more days, because I was just beside myself.
Okay, let me take a moment for self-aggrandizement, because back in 2000, it might have been 2001 when I played this at E3, I made a suggestion to Dennis that they should put in an insanity effect where memory cards got cleared off. And they had probably thought of it before. I'm not claiming credit for this being in the game, but it's a faint possibility, or at the very least, I verified their pre-existing plans to put that in there. But I gave him a lot of suggestions, and some of them made it in the game, and, you know, I don't know if they were that was because I suggested them, or I just happened to be in total agreement.
You know what the worst part is? That one comes up on a load.
Yeah.
It comes up outside of the game.
Well, that's what's fucked up about the insanity effects, is that they aren't really predictable. I mean, sometimes they happen between chapters when Alex and her grandfather start making out. You know, they there's some weird
PG-13
shit.
PG-13 kids.
And you know, all that, a lot of it was inspired by Psycho Mantis in Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah.
But yeah, totally. It's brilliant stuff. And in fact, my only complaint about these insanity effects is, number one, it's a little too hard to get the good ones. You have to play pretty poorly to really get the hardcore insanity effects that are fun to watch. So I think that's why they put in certain ones that will happen regardless of your sanity level. They're just basically preset points in the game where you will see an insanity effect. Like, what is it? After the second or third chapter, you get the thing that says, "Thanks for playing. Look forward to Eternal Darkness Sanity's Redemption." I mean, that's beautiful shit. And that's like less than a fourth of the way through the game.
Yeah. This one was especially bad, though, because not only does it say the memory card wiped, it actually boots you back out of the load screen, back to the main menu.
Yeah.
So there's some evil stuff.
I mean, there's like a blue screen of death in there somewhere.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I think
there's TYP mentioned one in the forums about there's one where the volume starts going up and down, and he said that the effect on the screen for that insanity effect looked exactly the same as the actual volume bar for his model of TV. So it drove him crazy trying to fix it. He thought his remote control was broken or something.
Well, actually, there was one time I was playing it with a friend of mine was over at my house, and I was playing the game, and all of a sudden my TV decided to like spontaneously combust, and just started making like his hideous like basically like explosion noise. It kept going. And I was like, oh shit, something wrong with the TV. And my friend's like, wait, maybe it's just an insanity effect.
And then smoke started coming out.
And then that's why half of his face is missing now, because we did nothing.
Aww.
No, it was Radio Free Nintendo takes a turn. But no. But yeah, it's
on this very special episode of RFN.
Did he have a coin that got the one side burnt as well?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That could be fun.
Those insanity effects are great, though.
Well, no, as far as with the insanity effects, like, I mean, some of them, yeah, kind of the outlandish ones, the kind of comedic. But there was one more subtle one that I quite like, where I think it was playing with the chubby Roivus fellow from the 18th century.
Maximilian.
And, he was like, there was a part towards the end of the level, maybe it was predetermined, because like I sort of was coming through from one room to another, and then all of a sudden you're in this very small room, and then the camera view sort of shifted and he was inside a cell. And of course that was foreshadowing what actually happens at the end of the chapter. And I quite like that you kind of like there was this little sort of back and forth there and a little payoff, and it was very different to the other ones, like, oh look, your head's just fallen off, or you know, this, that and the other. You know, it was a nice different way of using it, I thought was quite clever.
I really like how the camera kind of gets askew as your sanity goes down, because it's an almost subconsciously unsettling effect. I mean, as you get used to playing the game, it doesn't call attention to itself because you've seen it before, but at the same time, it does sort of ratchet up the tension as you're playing, because it's a little harder to see things, it's a little harder to keep track of where you are in relation to the camera, and it just gets worse and worse and worse as you lose sanity to the point where you really don't want the camera to be all cocked over when you're in combat, because it's just, you know, it's just hard to deal with. I think that's a great subtle effect, and some of them are really outlandish. I mean, when you walk into a room and your limbs start falling off and then you explode, that's a bit much for me. It's just unbelievable. I mean, is that really going to fool anybody?
Yeah, I think that's more like for, like I said, I think kind of
for giggles. Yeah, I guess so. One thing I don't like also is that the way, I guess it tends to happen for things that really couldn't be undone, but I don't like how some insanity effects will kind of go and they really got you fooled, and all of a sudden the screen flashes white and it resets. I'd prefer that it kind of let you simmer in it a little bit longer, or even that you actually had to complete that room with whatever crippling effect it had given you.
Yeah, I mean...
And then maybe if you failed, it would flash you back. But if you, I mean, maybe it's possible to succeed.
They could have mined that, though, for something. Because at certain times, you might have an insanity effect. You're kind of just waiting for it to end. And you're waiting for the white flash. And they could have really sort of like... Or like it white flashes straight to like something completely different. Or, you know, they could have really sort of milked that. But I don't think they did for a while I've played of it anyway.
I'm sure they had a lot of ideas that just there wasn't time or the technology
stop somewhere, isn't it? You know?
It just, you know, it makes me want a sequel so bad, because I think it's really a the game has so many brilliant ideas that were never really followed up on.
The thing is, if they were doing a sequel, would you like to see it stay very much in the adventure game tradition rather than go more action-y?
I don't know. I mean, I like that part of the game, but in terms of just pure concepts and innovation, I think a lot of them could be applied to a different kind of game, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'd like to see more, like, kind of a, you know, maybe a different take on this kind of storytelling, or, you know, at least this sort of style of story, because I think they do a great job with it, and I know they have ideas for other things to do in it if they ever get the chance. So, I mean, at one point, you know, Dennis was hinting at us that there were, you know, they potentially like 12 other chapters or something crazy
Some of the chapters they had in mind, a lot of them ones became variations on what actually made the game. So they had a bunch of ideas and they basically cut them, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, there was going to be a Crusade-themed level that was going to be in the tower. There was going to be the one set during the oil fires. Actually, you're going to be a soldier, and they changed it to a firefighter for some reason.
Yeah, I can see why they might have gone
and
that.
Then there was supposed to be another character that in the end killed himself, and they decided to back that one off.
Or Nintendo decided for them.
I really doubt it. I mean, this was, you know...
They said it was, quote, a little too dark. I'm like, really?
Yeah, I think they... Well,
the name of the game is Eternal
Darkness. Well, it depends on how it was handled. You know, suicide is not an easy topic to
approach.
No,
it's not.
In any context. And in a game, it's particularly thorny.
Yeah.
But the game is pretty dark. And that's one topic I wanted to get into in this first half of the discussion this week, is that not that we're only halfway through this week. I mean, you know, this week is the first half.
This week's part, yeah.
But I think the game's sense of maturity, or the mature way in which a lot of things are approached in the game, is not only admirable, but I think damn near unique. In that a lot of games that are so-called mature are really quite the opposite, you know. But Eternal Darkness really is not particularly gratuitous in any area that I can think of. And that kind of restraint is refreshing, I think. And the way that it does tell a very adult story, and by that I mean a story that a younger player probably won't appreciate, you know. It is not only scary, but it deals with very mature adult themes, and it's quite complex. The storytelling is you know, the kind of thing that you would want out of an adult book. Not an adult book in terms of pornographic or something.
That's what I want out of an adult book.
You know, I mean, when it comes down to it, I think most stories in video games are on the level of, say, a children's book. And I'm not putting down children's books, because I still read children's books. I love them. And I'm serious. I read Winnie the Pooh last year. I love that shit. But it is less sophisticated in general. And Eternal Darkness works more on the level of an actual novel that, you know, adult reading.
And of course, so much is tongue in cheek, or you know, it's inspired by things that are tongue in cheek. Obviously, Resident Evil, you know, kind of is very much inspired by, you know, the Romero movies, but then kind of is more silly than them, and just the terribleness of the voice acting kind of just adds to that even more so.
That's a great point. I mean, Eternal Darkness really does take itself seriously, and I don't think in a detrimental way. It doesn't take itself seriously,
because, well, we talked about the insanity effects are at times quite frivolous, but in terms of the core narrative, it's pretty straight and it's pretty earnest, you know. So that's not the intent. Obviously, there are shortcomings with the execution, but the intent is nice to see, and surprisingly kind of unique, even looking back at it sort of 7 years hence or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a few more forum comments that we can discuss a little before we wrap this up. Gojira posted, "The combat may be simple, but the ability to choose parts of the body to attack does keep it from being boring. Alex Roivas is probably one of the better female characters in video games that never gets mentioned." I think Alex is a great character. You don't learn... I mean, you kind of get a lot of characterization of her at the very beginning, I guess, and then after that, she's really just an avatar until the end of the game.
Yeah.
But she is, you know, it's really nice that they don't take advantage of her. You know, they're not trying to show her cleavage. She doesn't have a giant ass. She doesn't wear a bikini. And you know, it's funny because her character modeling, she reminds me of the other character that usually gets pointed out as being a really nice female character in gaming, and she looks almost exactly like Samus Aran when she takes her helmet
off.
But
is Samus Aran really a character? Is she really
Sure. Yeah.
I think the reason they get away with Samus is that she doesn't really have a personality or that much of a story, so they don't really take any opportunity to ruin her. But I think Alex is a great female character.
She's a good character. Of course, some of that is because sad to say, the bar is low.
Yeah,
it is very low.
Unfortunately,
But she is a good character,
But it's just part of the. In many ways, you know, simply a function. Like I said, Jennifer Hale's voice acting is quite good, but it's simply a function of the fact that, you know, like you said, they just didn't do anything stupid. It's like
they didn't fuck it up.
Exactly, you know, I mean, it's really that simple sometimes, you know.
I know.
That's what they did with it. And I mean, with the combat thing, I would say the only thing I kind of wish that they'd made it a little more. I mean, I don't know, maybe this happens later in the game, but that it was a little more imperative that you kind of work the different parts of the body.
There is, depending if you chose
the different paths.
Yes, because there can be some differences there. The effect where they look at you and their eyes glow and you lose a bar. Well, if they're red, you're going to lose health.
So you want to knock the head off.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it would have been nice if you had certain, like, say for instance, certain characters, I don't know, certain enemy characters, like, had like some sort of claw on the one arm that was, like, particularly deadly, so you wanted to get that off straight away.
Well, there's the Reapers, I think is what they're called, the Reapers or something, that they have armored wings, essentially, they can protect themselves with. And you do have to aim for body parts to take them out. And they are particularly deadly.
They're the red skeleton, the red zombies that kind of regenerate, so you really have to kind of knock off all the limbs. By the way, strategic dismemberment, this game did it first.
Yes.
So take that in Dead Space.
So knock out those legs and you're good to go.
It does sometimes matter the order that you remove limbs or whether you target limbs at all. And the other thing that this reminds me of that I wanted to talk about is just, for one thing, how great the melee weapons are.
Oh, yeah.
This was, at the time, this was like one of the huge differences between ED and Resident Evil. Yeah, because in Resident Evil, you really didn't have melee combat at all. And so not only does Eternal Darkness have it, but it works really well, and in most cases, I would prefer to use a melee weapon to guns.
Once I got the tulwars, I mean, I was good to go.
And the cool thing is, they do a lot of interesting things with it. I mean, you have, like, dual wielding for some of the weapons, which is really cool. It makes you pretty much a badass. Game encourages combat, and that was what Dennis used to always say back in the day, is that, you know, in Resident Evil, you're basically supposed to run away. They don't give you enough ammo. You're not meant to kill every enemy. It's almost impossible to kill every enemy in Resident Evil. In Eternal Darkness, we want you to fight. We want you to be empowered. If you run away, you'll go insane and die. And the way that you regain sanity
because you
is
have
by
like
killing
the,
enemies.
You have, like, the finishing move thing that actually sort of regains maintains your sanity and stuff like that, so you're encouraged to completely finish them off and then.
And there's some risk reward there too, because if you're surrounded by enemies, you may not want to take the time to finish one off, because they will attack you while you do that.
So I think they did a pretty this sort of very like I said, it is very adventure gamey, but when you could, so the combat sort of facet is really good within that, you know, because I don't think it's like necessarily the whole point of the game or anything, but it's pretty well executed. The only thing I would say is that there's portions of it where I thought it was a little too much. Like there was a part, I think it was towards the end of the one of the Persian chapters, where there's a barrier and you pretty much you pretty much have to fight like four or five waves of enemies, and it's quite slow.
Yeah,
and
the
combat is not that good that it supports just that.
That's a bit much. I think that was a way for them to sort of surrogate a boss battle for that chapter. There are a couple boss battles in the game, but they tend to be more towards the end.
Yeah, and they're not fun.
Yeah, you know, that maybe is where it breaks down.
Yeah,
their
stage set in World War I, that boss battle is a pain.
Yeah, well, the one thing I really like about the combat, and I don't think this gets enough credit, is the hit detection. Because as powerful and as nice, you know, unlimited as the melee weapons are, when you get in a really tight space, you might actually prefer to use a gun, because the melee weapons will hit the walls.
Yeah,
they'll hit the columns.
You'll get stuck on things, yeah.
Yeah, so if you're, you know, you have to think, okay, I'm in this tight hallway, should I really be trying to swing a sword? Maybe not. It doesn't make sense. And how many games go to that length, you know, provide that much detail where you actually have to think, you know, this isn't a good situation to be using a sword, because my sword doesn't go through the wall like it does in every other video game.
And in fact, in the tower, which is the Persian levels, the Tulwar is actually kind of obnoxious in that respect, because there's a lot of narrow passageways.
Yeah, it can be.
But it's, but it's
so
powerful.
So you might
want to
use the chakra or the chamra.
Yeah, but it's such a powerful sword that, you know, you want to use it, but you really can't.
And you also have the torch, and the torch has its own drawbacks. You can't really finish off enemies to regain sanity. But the torch, oh man, I love the lighting effects when you use the torch. You know, anybody who complains about the game being too dark, I would say, you know, sometimes you should pull out the torch, because it's actually designed that way. It may not be your favorite weapon, but it's not just a weapon, it's a tool, and it makes a huge difference. When you pull that thing out, you can actually see where you're going. So it's a bit like, I don't know, Doom 3 or Half-Life or whatever you want to compare it to, but they actually used the lighting technology to affect the gameplay there, and I think it's done extremely well. But anyway, moving on, Maxi posted, I was reading one of my Nintendo Powers and somebody was hooking up a sound surround system. This person asked what were some good games that would sound nice with surround sound. Nintendo Power answered with F-Zero GX and Eternal Darkness. For those who take the green path, I recommend you hook up a surround sound setup. So
yeah, the sound design in general is one of the outstanding elements of the game. I really think so. It's very good. And also good to play with headphones as well. Surround sound is good, but headphones is kind of slightly more intimate, and that works very nicely.
And the relevance there of the green path is that if you choose the green path with Pius in the very first chapter, basically the enemies will attack your sanity more than, you know, it affects the kind of enemies that you have to deal with, and to some extent the access you have to magic. To different kinds of magic. It affects the order that you get the different alignments. So if you choose the green path, basically you'll have to work a lot harder to keep your sanity bar up throughout the game. And so you're more likely to see a lot of really cool sanity effects. So that's
right.
Why he...
Yeah, and there's a lot of the lot of that in the sound design, like these sort of like banging noises and kind of crying and screaming.
Right.
Just kind of starts rising in the ambience.
Torches popping. That's a good one.
as you get more
right.
And more
and the red low. The red is probably a little bit harder, and then the blue.
The red is the hardest, and blue is easiest.
Yeah, because blue you just lose your magic ability with a K,
which regenerates as you walk around.
Right now,
red is very difficult.
It is. It's actually quite difficult. Now, if you're a fun fact for anybody who hasn't noticed it, you can actually get a fourth elemental in the game.
Oh sure, I just got it in my game today.
Yeah, I can't remember what it does though. Because I remember
Mantarok basically dominates all others. Yeah, it's almost like a cheat mode.
Yeah,
because like, the magic is so powerful that I mean, you can you know, at the time that you get the Mantarok rune, you can cast spell 11. I don't remember what it's actually called because I don't have the scroll yet, but I discovered it. And it puts a little rune over your head, and if you use the Mantarok alignment for it, it regenerates all three of your bars as you run around.
Yes.
And it lasts for a couple minutes depending on the power level.
What does the heal spell do if you have Mantarok?
It recovers your magic, I mean your health and insanity.
So it does still cost you magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cuz I remember that the first time I didn't have it, and I actually found out about it in the back of an EGM. Like an hour after I passed the spot where
it's
you can get
it. It's pretty tricky
to
get, and it requires a little backtracking in that level.
Yeah, I had actually
definitely worth it.
Just passed definitely. It. And I was so mad at myself. But it's actually quite useful in some of the later levels.
It is, yeah. It makes the later stuff a lot easier,
yeah.
That's for sure.
Well, and it makes sense that it dominates based on the story.
Sure.
Which, how often would you say this game mechanic makes sense based on the story?
Yeah, there's a lot of that in Eternal Darkness, though. Mm-hmm. So, Golden Phoenix posted, the bathtub scene was really the only thing that startled me in the game, which was fine because I prefer psychological scares that creep you out more than boo scares like Resident Evil used to do.
The bathtub scene felt kind of weird.
I thought it was out of place.
It is a boo scare, but it's kind of, you know, it's not a dog jumping through a window.
It's like
a zombie
it's
dog.
It's like the infamous thing, like, you know, that Panic and parody from Dino Crisis, where, you know, you're walking down a hallway and then a dinosaur comes in through the window.
Yes.
And, you know, no one is freaked out about it. And the dinosaur was like, would it be scary if I came around the other side? It's like, yeah, go for it, whatever. But that bathtub scene though is really like it just seems out of place as far as like everything else, you know.
Yeah, I guess I kind of get the feeling the intent with that was that, you know, like you go around places in the game, kind of maybe at somewhat absentmindedly, kind of clicking everything.
Yeah.
And then in that case, you click something and something sort of shocks you, and it's like maybe you'll kind of think a bit differently. It'll make you a little bit wary for the rest of the game, like whenever you might click something crazy might happen.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, I prefer how they handled it with the statue, the bust that follows you.
That's because it doesn't really ever admit that. It's just kind of there.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, give you some big shot of it, like, look at that. It's kind
Yeah,
it's
you
just...
might even walk by it a couple times without noticing it, and then maybe the third time you're like, oh, shit, that's creepy, you know? I prefer that kind of thing. But, yeah, the bathtub scene, it doesn't bother me. I am, like Golden Phoenix, I'm glad that they didn't do more of that because I think it could have gotten a bit tiresome, as it tends to do in some of the Resident Evils.
I don't really feel like it fit in. You know.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Flames of Chaos, who a brand new staff member actually at Nintendo World Report.
Oh,
posted.
You want to give his name?
Yeah, his name's Lucas. You'll see him. Hi,
Lucas.
He would be the one posting news. So Flames of Chaos posted, my favorite aspect of the game is how you play characters from the Roivus lineage to defeat the evil that the Roman Centurion unleashed upon the world. The final boss was awesome because it had an epic feeling once you saw the spirits of the dead helping you to defeat Pius. Hopefully we didn't spoil that for anybody, but...
Oops.
I mean, the reason I put this in here is because it is kind of cool the way that the characters link together. They cross paths, even though they live in different eras of time. A lot of them have certain connections to Alex that she, you know, sort of... She's kind of shocked to realize as she reads the book that, oh my god, you know, there is some link to this person, And I think Greg was saying earlier that it's kind of nice how it deals with all that as you get towards the end of the game. Even though some of these characters die, they're still present. They're still part of the game even afterwards, and it handles that in various ways. But part of that is the final boss battle. Yeah.
And in fact, at some point, two of them physically actually come out and help other characters during the point of the game after their supposed death.
Oh, really? I don't even remember
that. Yeah, so Anthony does, as a zombie.
I loved playing as a guy who's slowly becoming a zombie.
And
I can't remember her name now,
the dancer. She actually gives the Mantarok rune to the archaeologist, I believe.
Oh, the Mantarok, the heart of Mantarok.
Yes.
Not the rune.
Right,
yeah.
The heart of Mantarok.
So Stratos posted, I have been struck by the game's theme of dying heroes. Many of these characters you play as face grisly and horrifying deaths. I remember the first time I played as the Cambodian girl.
Talk about her.
Yeah. I was shocked and in denial of her death for half the game. You begin to wonder when and how any of your characters will meet their end. Excuse me. You lose your sense of safety that a typical game grants you. Combine that with the sanity effects, and you may think a hallucinated death is the real deal and the end of that chapter. It's true. Yeah. Or yeah. You might even think that, you know, I read comments by some people who got in a tough fight, the enemy killed them, and they thought they would come back to life. They thought it was an insanity effect.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you just need to be better at the game.
Yeah, because there was an incident with like that where I walked into a room and was instantly killed by one of those bird-like creatures with the tail sabers, like literally within a second. And I was like, well, that couldn't have been real. No, it was real. No, they really got me with a one-hit kill.
You should definitely save often. The game can be has moments of
just unfair
of, spikes in difficulty occasionally. So it's not necessarily easy, but it does depend a lot on the path. If you chose blue, you're probably in pretty good shape.
If you chose red, you're already fucked.
You pretty much, yeah. I wish it gave you a little more indication before.
Yeah, because I picked red the first time. Yeah. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, it's really tough on red. But it's a great challenge if you've played through it before.
Yeah, if you went red, green, blue, by the time you get to blue, it's not even hard anymore. It's just absurd.
All right, guys, that's going to end our Retroactive for this week. We'll be back next week to finish things up, and hopefully Mr. Lindemann will come. And I know he's been playing the game a lot. He has a lot of thoughts on it, so I want him to get a chance to share his. And if you have not yet joined the forum thread, we'd love to hear what you think about Eternal Darkness. You can go to Nintendo World Report forums and discuss it there with your fellow listeners and us, and we will pick a few more comments for next week to read on the show. You can also vote in the poll for the next game.
Pick Drill Dozer.
Drill Dozer is not on the list.
Anymore? Not no? Damn.
No, we change the games every time, actually. And it lost, but we will bring back losing games in future polls. We'll keep trying to mix it up and give everything a fair shot or three. So, with that, we're going to take another break, and we'll be back for a quick round of your listener mail.
Hey there, Radio Free Nintendo listeners. It's me again, Carl Castaneda, your host from a long, long time ago. The cast and crew here at NintendoWorldReport.com has been kind enough to let me advertise my new show, Taco 112, again. So without further ado, let's take a little trip away from Zelda and Mario and spend a little talk time together. You know, something that I really think makes Taco 112 special is how we all really come together as a family and respect one another. Take this, for instance. Wow, that was really something, huh? Well, how about this little dandy?
Carl sucks.
Well, isn't that one just a humdinger? Once again, it's Talk 112, TAWK-112 at iTunes, or your podcast aggregator of choice. Thanks again, and enjoy the show.
Okay, we're back with listener mail. Sorry we couldn't do it last week, but we're going to try to catch up a bit here. Yeah. Carl has the first question.
Okie doke. Adolf writes from Denton, Texas. Do you think Capcom will port?
Sorry. Why don't you try that again?
He wants to know if Capcom's going to port things.
Is there something intrinsically ridiculous about that idea?
I said pork Resident Evil the first time. Sorry about that.
Pork. Do you think...
I barely know it.
Whoa.
I'm so sorry, Adolf. All right. Do you think Capcom will port Resident Evil Outbreak 1 and 2 to the Wii?
As in ahoy, not as in oink.
Of course. It shouldn't be a difficult pork, and...
Oh, she's easy.
And putting both games together will make for a better package. Oh, Jesus. Since they're short, with Wii speed...
ruined. This question is ruined.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, this question has been asked and answered on another podcast that yes. sent it to. So.
with Wii Speak and tighter controls, this could be a nice revisit to a game not many people played.
Okay, so...
Outbreak, the online Resident Evil with no voice chat that nobody played except Ty Sugar, who loved it.
And it's which basically like means it was terrible.
The sedate version of surviving a zombie apocalypse as opposed to like Left 4 Dead.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, there. I think a lot of people would probably prefer Outbreak to be forgotten. But, you know, if you add Wii Speak support and you improve controls and a few other things, I don't know that much about the game, but I know it had a lot of problems.
Yeah.
It could potentially be interesting, and Capcom is certainly, as we've already joked about, they love porting their old games. I mean, just today they announced, along with the sequel to Umbrella Chronicles, which really we don't even need to discuss, they are releasing in the U.S. the Wii remakes, if you can even call them that, of Resident Evil the remake that first came out on GameCube.
The remake of
Resident
Evil
Zero.
Remake squared.
It's not even. It's really more of a port. I mean, I've heard they don't even really have motion.
It's classic controller, isn't it? Or at least it supports.
It is literally a re-release on Wii, which is pointless since these were GameCube games.
Yes.
You can already play them on your Wii.
You can't find them. I think is the issue.
Maybe that's the case.
No, actually, you can find Resident Evil the remake and Zero really, really easily. Because the thing is, GameStop. Great prices, great games.
Do
you remember when Capcom released the Resident Evil anthology package or something
GameCube?
It had like every Resident Evil.
It had Resident Evil Zero and Resident Evil Remake. I know because as a patsy, I bought one, and they have like thousands
it's from
of
the from the makers of Killer 7, right?
Patsyism.
Very nice. Very nice.
But they love re-releasing shit, so I wouldn't rule it out, even though Outbreak is a bit obscure and kind of unloved. But I wouldn't put it past Capcom to re-release anything. So they put Resident Evil 2 on game.com.
Ooh.
So yeah.
Woo! Perfect.
It's within the realm of plausibility.
I would like a copy of Resident Evil 2 on game.com, because honestly... that was the most well-crafted piece of video game hardware that's ever been created. If your game system doesn't have Tiger Electronics' seal of approval, it's not worth playing.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
So, Ryan writes in from Anaheim, California. While it's nice to see Night Games, Swords and Soldiers, and Eduardo the Samurai Toaster being highlighted in Nintendo's...
Jesus.
Recent 2009 lineup announcement, I can't help but feel that Nintendo is doing a disservice to interesting WiiWare games by not offering downloadable demos. For reasons I'll never understand, Nintendo has always been opposed to demos. Demo discs for GameCube were rare, and as far as I know, there hasn't been a single one for Wii. Disc-based games can at least be rented. WiiWare doesn't share that luxury. Is Nintendo hobbling WiiWare by stubbornly refusing to catch up to PlayStation 1 standards? Well, that is a really unfair comparison, considering PlayStation 1 did not have downloadable games.
No, but it did have demo discs that were easily distributed.
Mm-hmm. They did, and Nintendo did some of that on GameCube.
Kind
of.
I remember there being like two different demos they actually put out.
It is really interesting that there haven't been anything on Wii at all. There are no Wii demo discs at all.
No.
But they've done, with the DS, they've done the Nintendo Channel stuff, which is great.
And in fact, not only are there no demo discs available, at game stores, Wii displays have a game in them. There's not like that sampler pack they used to have for GameCube stuff.
Yeah, well, most people only want to demo one game on Wii, and that's Wii Sports.
And usually that's not what's in there.
Yeah, but, Nintendo has historically been opposed to demos. It was a Yamauchi thing. He believed that if you had easy access to demos, you wouldn't buy the full
game.
And Nintendo has backed away from that stance in the time that since Yamauchi left the company or stepped down from his position. He hasn't exactly left. he's still getting all his dividends, but they haven't been all that forthcoming, except with DS. They've been really good with the DS demos, and they've even made it so you can get one in your home through a Wii, which is great. Mm-hmm. But they haven't done downloadable Wii games, and that, you know, partially is, I'm sure, up to the storage solution deal. Mm. But in terms of WiiWare, I don't think it's that fair, because if you think about the model of WiiWare, they are kind of asking independent developers to take a risk, put their game on WiiWare, and Nintendo's basically saying, we don't require anything from you. There's no Xbox certification here. You know, you can pretty much, you make it, we'll post it, people can buy it. And they, I can understand why they don't want to require guys like 2D Boy to make demos of their games. At the same time, 2D Boy, a company of two people, made a demo of their game that you can get on PC. Mm-hmm. So why isn't that demo available on Wii? I don't have a good answer for that. Mm. It should be, you know. It can't be that large. It can't be larger than the actual World of Goo download. And it's certainly possible to distribute it over WiiWare, just like you can the full game.
Well, I like what Xbox Live does with their arcade games. When you download a trial for an arcade game, you are actually downloading the same amount of space that it would take
to
get the game.
Completely unreasonable given the storage limitations on Wii. You can't do it that way.
Well, the thing is, though, is that when you actually go to buy the game, it just unlocks the game that you've already got. You don't actually.
I'm not saying it's a bad system, Carl. I'm saying it is
on
not
Wii,
possible.
It's not, on yeah, Wii. It's not really transferable. Well, because who's gonna like clear out the fridge to play a demo? You know, like who's gonna go to that effort?
That's fair.
I think that is some of the issue, certainly.
But I do think, you know, basically the problem here, and World of Goo is the perfect example. Even when developers are willing to make a demo and they actually make one, they still can't actually serve it over WiiWare.
Yeah,
and they should be able to. That's the problem. I don't think Nintendo should require all WiiWare developers to make demos, because, like I said, it's kind of inconsistent with the whole philosophy of the platform. But it should be an option, and right now it's not. So in that sense, I say, yeah, you're right.
Jolly, just speculatively, I mean, do you think, like, obviously, because some people, you know, will end up buying WiiWare games because they kind of want to try it and there isn't a demo? And then on the other hand, you know, people might sort of back away from making a purchase if they can't sort of know what they're getting into, which with WiiWare is quite frequent because quite often we really don't know that much about certain games that will just appear. So I mean, you think it's, there isn't one dominant effect over the other.
I think it's probably more negative than positive, but there is some positive effect. There are people who will download a game out of sheer curiosity because they have no other way to try it.
I mean, if you hadn't gotten a hold of a demo of Cocoteau Fishing Master,
well, that's the thing. A demo can have a negative effect on sales.
Yeah.
I mean, Yamauchi was not totally wrong about that. If you play the demo and the demo is too much, it's too much of a vertical slice. If the demo is basically the whole game with some minor limitation,
which with WiiWare,
you don't have any incentive to buy it, and that could easily happen with WiiWare. If the demo is so bad, it's a bad game and the demo is simply accurate
reflective
representation of the bad game, that will make you not want to buy it. So, I mean, demos affect sales both ways. Demos of good games tend to drive sales. Demos of bad games tend to drive sales down. And bad demos drive sales down. And it's easy to make a bad demo, even of a good game. I've played hundreds of them, trust me. So it's a complicated question, but I do, you know, whether Nintendo offers demos of their own games or not is their decision, but I do think in terms of WiiWare, they should give the option. There's really no reason
If the developer wants to do it, then it's on them. You know, that's their decision. Yeah,
exactly.
I think Nintendo probably just doesn't want to have to create
the structure for that when it's only going to be perhaps a minority that would want to do
maybe
it.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's not too late for them to implement that. I mean, the way the Wii Shop works, they can easily upgrade it. So it is something possible.
We've been waiting 2.5 years for them to fix the SD thing.
They've got time. It's coming.
They did partially fix the SD problem.
No, they didn't.
They partially fixed it. The transfer speeds are about 5 times faster than they used to be. So that's a step in the right direction.
It's still a step in the right direction along the edge of a cliff into Shitville.
Yeah. All right, Sophia writes, what have any of you done that was either within a game or related to gaming that you feel bad about or thought was particularly evil in relation to another person? It could be an exploit or cheat that you used to win a multiplayer game. Perhaps even more evil, you sold a friend a copy of E.T. the Extraterrestrial for $50.
Not so much evil as possibly the greatest sales job of all time, that would be, considering how infamously terrible it is.
Yeah, I'd feel good about myself if I'd made bucks off E.T.
I have one that I've been doing recently, which is like me and one of my roommates have been continually doing this to each other, where when one person is close to getting an achievement in a game, the other person will fuck that up for them. like most recently, you get an achievement, I think, for completing the game on Street Fighter 4 on like the highest difficulty, like getting perfects or whatever. And he was like a round away from doing this, so I pressed start on the player 2 controller right before he beat the game. And
does it not go back to the single player after you finish with Versus? It should be a two way street.
Yeah, you can, but I don't think he realized it at the time.
I think it might reset your.
I think it might reset your
achievement too.
I think it resets achievement, especially because you wouldn't be getting perfect.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah, right. So that's pretty terrible. And then I guess in the game, when I blew up Megaton in Fallout 3, that was pretty bad.
Nice.
I was thinking stuff like there's some stuff in God of War that's specifically designed to make you feel bad when you do it. You don't really have a choice, but it's just part of the game. And the same with BioShock.
BioShock, give you this choice,
It's very tempting to just kill the little sisters and harvest their atom, and that's actually what I did. I didn't feel that bad because they're so creepy.
Yeah,
Johnny kills creepy kids.
All right,
I didn't look at them as little girls. I looked at them as these kind of genetic mutants, so I didn't feel so bad about.
What's it called? I hope I'm not spoiling BioShock for anybody. But I'm gonna where you go to Andrew Ryan, where you're gonna kill him finally. And like you got like I think it's like a golf club you got in your hands or something, and like he's just screaming at you to kill him. I like didn't want to kill him, but you have to go through it. So that was a pretty poignant moment, I thought, in the game.
Oh, I was happy to kill him.
Really? Oh, I felt bad.
Yeah. So and then I also wrote down GTA. There are certain missions in the GTA games where they tell you to go whack a guy, and it's like, I don't know this guy. I don't know that he's done anything bad. I mean, usually the characters you kill aren't. There aren't totally innocent, they tend to be people who are involved with the underworld or whatever, but at the same time, it's like, I don't have any personal problem with this guy. Why do I have to kill him? He's a character, he's got a name, and he's got a voice actor, and he's got lines of dialogue. They've minimally developed this character, and now I'm going to kill him, and I don't really have any reason to, except the game told me to.
Well, I think that with GTA 4, they really, aside from killing random strangers on the street, I can't think of any real missions in the game where you're killing, good people.
Well, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying there are no good people in GTA anyway. Yeah. But you're killing people when you don't really have any good reason to.
Yeah, that's fair.
When you have to go kill Playboy X or whatever the other guy's name is. True. The game tells you, the game basically says, you have to kill one of these guys. And I'm like, you know what? Why can't I just leave him be? I don't really see any pressing need to kill one of the two. It's like, if it gave me the choice to kill neither or both of them or either, then I would find it a more interesting part of the game. But because the game literally just says, okay, you have to bifurcate the storyline here, choose one or the other. You have to kill one of them. I'm like, come on, why? That's stupid. It takes me out of the game. But there are occasionally times when I feel kind of bad just because it's so impersonal in GTA a lot of the time. Outside of a game, I can think of a couple times where publishers sent us multiple copies of a game, or maybe they sent us a game for Xbox or something that we couldn't review, and it wasn't something that I could donate to Child's Play. Maybe it was rated M, or something.
Yeah.
And so I would take it to Walmart and say that it was a gift, and I didn't have the system to play it on, and they would give me, if it was around the right time of year, I didn't have a receipt, but and they would give me full store credit for it.
That's how I ended up with Battlefield Modern Combat.
Felt a little bad for that.
For the PS2.
It's like, I didn't really feel it was stealing, because they were games that I thought Walmart would sell to somebody else, but it was dishonest.
That game just traveled a couple extra 100 miles to get to their home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I would have felt worse about taking it to GameStop and handing them a shrink-wrapped brand new game and getting $20 for it so they could, you know, sell it to somebody else for 40.
I've totally been able to get full credit for that stuff at GameStop.
I've heard stories of that, but I think they're a little more discerning than the customer service desk at Walmart.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That's definitely true.
Yeah. Okay, James has the next question.
So, Aviet writes in from Salt Lake City, Utah. Do you have any information about DSI apps? Heard anything about GPS or interactive maps and note-taking? Thanks.
Well, we did the moving memo pads definitely coming, the one they had in Japan.
It's Miyamoto's project, right?
Yeah, but yeah, in terms of like in Japan, they have got a lot of app stuff, like a lot of the DSiWare stuff is apps, like, I mean, silly little stuff like Animal Crossing calculators and
clocks.
Yeah, but also like the tube, like the public transport stuff.
Yeah,
you know, like so. I assume they will do some of that for the Western markets, but we just don't know about it yet. A GPS, I would assume, is not really feasible because
you have to have an actual satellite signal receiver to do GPS. It's a hardware issue.
On a quick tangent though about the GPS thing. Whenever I think of GPS apps, I think of a certain app that I heard about, and we talked about this on Talk One Tool, so Greg will probably know what I'm talking about. The application where basically it's a GPS-based social network, so it'll point out people who are using the GPS within your general area, and you can then interact with them even though you're in their general area through the GPS app. So that dude who's in that same coffee shop as you, who's on the other side, you can poke him and ask for a game of Scrabble instead of actually interacting with the motherfucker.
It's just safer.
Progress is what I'm saying.
Social progress.
Oh, yeah.
All right, and Greg has the last question.
Okay, this is from Mario is French, writes in from Toronto, Canada. In a recent podcast, Mr. Met states that we have yet to see a game where death is taken seriously. I promise you that it will never happen. Honestly, it's very hard to take death seriously when most of the popular games right now across all three platforms at least have some death in it. Thinking as a designer, it is futile and unrewarding for game designers to design a game with any sort of meaningful death. Do you think it's worth designing a game that can be relatively popular whilst having a death as a kind of emotional impact on the player?
Eternal Darkness says hello.
Yeah, seriously.
I think more adventure kind of games are more predisposed because obviously, I guess what you say is a lot of action games, there is a sort of routine death. Like it may be of sort of trivial characters or even somewhat sort of dehumanized characters, but it just happens so often it's kind of like much of a muchness. Whereas like with an adventure game that's not action based or anything, you know, it's primarily about the narrative and things, and obviously the gameplay is not about killing stuff, it might be about puzzle solving or whatever, then I don't see any reason within those contexts that you couldn't do something where you had emotionally impactful deaths. It's just, you know, you have to deliver a narrative that's good enough, and also I guess the other part of the question that he's kind of mentioning is, are those kinds of games ever going to be that popular?
Final Fantasy VII sold like 10 million copies. So, and Chrono Trigger, you know, is an extremely popular game, and that has a major character dying.
Do you think something that really focused so strongly on story and narrative, like that was like an adventure type game, like is ever going to be as big as your sort of, you know, your GTAs and your Call of Duties and stuff like that? I mean, I guess it's some of what he might be saying.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, for one thing, we don't have that many games that tell a good enough story for it to matter. I think, Greg, you said it perfectly. The value of death in a game really tracks very directly with how much effort was put into the storytelling.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, in Gears of War, who gives a shit when somebody dies? Everybody dies. It's a stupid story.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a bad game, but it's just, you know, it's just not what it's about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, we don't have that many games who take their storytelling seriously enough for death to matter. But it has been done, it will be done again, and some of these games are reasonably popular. Final Fantasy VII is huge, Chrono Trigger is moderately popular, Eternal Darkness was moderately popular. So yeah, I think it is worthwhile if that's the kind of game that you want to make, and if you can market it and sell to people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's an interesting point in terms of to what extent, you know, do you think some of the reason for, the failure in some respects to get good narratives is market driven, that people just don't see it as necessarily the most lucrative way to spend your time developing
a lot
a game
of it's market driven.
You know, so exactly, well, I guess that's kind of what he's saying, really, is the fact that, you know, it not necessarily in their best interests. If you're maybe you're just better off spending more time polishing up the game technically, and because that's, you know, very much what reviewers tend to be kind of preoccupied with and things like that.
Yeah, but I don't know, these games that I mentioned were all very well received by the critics, and they sold extremely well. So
I think that's the thing. I think it can happen, and hopefully, you know, I mean, I still think, you know, there is a very, people kind of, you know, poo-poo the importance of better graphics and stuff, but ultimately, you know, especially in terms of, you know, when you get further and further along in terms of, you know, the character models and actual, you know, real credible acting coming through a character model, people will start to experiment with it more and see what they can do.
Sure. And then, you know, to bring up a comparison that's very much in the popular culture right now, look at Watchmen. I mean, comic books are the ultimate media in which death doesn't matter, because everybody knows in comic books people come back to life no matter how many times they die. They always find some stupid explanation for why somebody comes back to life.
That was a robot Superman.
And there was a robot Superman, and in Watchmen, you know, Alan Moore basically said, "Look, you can do death in this medium, and take it seriously." And, you know, it's just one of many things that he kind of innovated with that graphic novel. And you know, I think a Watchmen kind of advancement in gaming is going to happen if it hasn't already happened. I mean, you can make the argument for certain examples, but it's completely possible. So it's just a matter of the medium, you know, maturing a little bit. But it's not unheard of, and it's not impossible either. Well, we need to wrap up the show, so I want to thank everybody who emailed and posted in the forums. We are still catching up on a few emails, so if you haven't heard yours read on the show yet, don't worry. We will get to it if it's a good question or a good comment. And please keep sending those. We've had some great ones lately. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And like I said, Eternal Darkness Retroactive Forum thread is still going on. We'd love to see your comments, and you might have a chance to be read on next week's episode. Don't forget to vote for the next retroactive game, which will start in a few weeks here. And Carl, you want to plug your podcast again?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. It's Talk 112. That's TAWK-112. You can find it on iTunes or your podcast aggregator of choice. Yeah, check it out if you'd like. Maybe I'll convince Greg into putting up a new commercial. I don't know.
Oh, it better be good.
Nice.
And
there
one
be
more
lots of groveling in it.
One more thing. Speaking of groveling, though, seriously though, I cannot congratulate the site and staff enough for making it to year 10. That's a big fucking deal in Internetville.
We're actually in year 11 now.
Well, making it past year 10 is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm not going to argue semantics with you, Mets.
No. Thank you very much.
Seriously,
I don't mean to sound ungrateful.
You know, like, you know, having served, you know, a bit of time with them, you know, 3 years of my staff time, it's tough work.
Serve time, ouch.
Yeah. You know,
nice.
But I finally got out after months of therapy. But, no, really, like, they're some of the hardest working guys I know, especially Johnny. And, you know, I remember having a conversation with Stan one time saying that when we were the glory years of my time at PGC, as it was at the time, where it was when Johnny was director, and it was really like, we really did think of Johnny as being the guy in charge. And even after Steven had taken
over, I was
oh yeah, you were the guy in, but I really mean it was like the dude who knew shit. Like when anyone had a problem, you took it to Johnny and he was able to take care of it. And that was really, you know, and Steven did a really great job when he took over. And, you know, Lindy's doing a fantastic job. So, yeah, I just wanted to give a little clap to all the directors, past and present.
Is he dribbling?
What? No, I think that was his clapping.
Because I'm holding a microphone in one hand, and so I can't really clap.
Oh, beautiful.
Okay. Sound of one hand clapping.
One hand clapping.
Yeah. There it is. It's on tape.
Yeah. Discovered.
Somebody call the Onion.
So now that sweet moment has been spoiled by you assholes, Yeah, just wanted to say, really though, you guys are doing really great. And hey, RFN anniversary number 3 is coming up soon, isn't it?
It's not long.
Not long from there.
We're heading up to 150 pretty soon.
Yeah, maybe
Good
we
Lord.
Can.
Kind of scary.
Maybe we can coax Sklens and Burchfield into doing another segment.
I think by the end of the year, there will if God willing, we last that long on the podcast. we will have had more episodes of RFN than there were of One Up Yours.
Wow. Perfect.
Yeah, be accurate, yeah.
They made it up to in the 160s, I think. Pretty scary.
Sweet.
All right, so thanks, Carl, for being on the show. Thanks, anytime. Greg and James, for sitting this one out. Sitting this one in for so long. That's what
yes.
I meant.
Disparaging.
and we wish John the best at work, and we look forward to having him back as soon as possible. All right, that's going to be it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Always been on Busey.
Wow.
I think that was on the last Sigur Rós album. Carl, did you in fact steal the idea for top 5 from Film Spotting?
No.
Never.
Because I just want to say, you know, when we steal features for RFN, at least we change the name.
Oh, I have no reason to. No one listens to my show, Johnny. No one's going to know that I stole it.
Okay.
Nice. So when he introduces himself and he starts introducing us the wrong podcast, we know it's all over for Tarp.
Oh my god, there have been multiple times when I've started the show and I've said hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Radio Free Nintendo. It's happened.
The old magic kicks in.
Nice.
Perfect.